This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. It's been about 24 years since one of the country's largest metropolitan areas was racked by violence. The 1992 Los Angeles Rebellion was sparked by the acquittal of police involved in the videotaped beating of Rodney King. It resulted in 55 people killed over 6 days. Now, many people have tried to make sense of what that moment meant in the history of race relations in the U.S. Today, given the growing influence of the Black Lives Matter movement, the questions of race and racism are more important than ever. My guest is Lynn Mie Itagaki. She is an assistant professor of English and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and program coordinator in Asian American Studies at Ohio State University. And her new book is called Civil Racism, the 1992 Los Angeles Rebellion and the Crisis of Racial Burnout. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how significant was the Los Angeles Rebellion in 1992 in terms of the dialogue on race and racism at that time in U.S. history?
Very significant. I don't think I can underscore how much it meant to the history of the United States, not only in terms of what many people might consider the post-civil rights era, so a kind of a backlash or kind of retrenchment from the gains in legislation, in Supreme Court cases that the civil rights movement had won in the struggles of the Black freedom struggles. And in the 1990s, what you have, not only the legacy of the Reagan era in rolling back quite a number of the various gains of the civil rights movement, but now what you have is this feeling of what at the time was considered balkanization, or the fracturing of the U.S. Society, because many people felt that the inroads that multiculturalism had made into U.S. education, into hiring practices, into our society was going to result in a kind of breakdown of U.S. culture and U.S. government. And what you also saw, too, is that it was also a response to the post-Cold War era and the breakup of the USSR paradigm and the way that we understood the world. And so when you had so many kinds of civil wars going on in around the world and people saw the violence in Los Angeles, there were many comparisons to Lebanon, to what was going on in South Africa, and that people were concerned that the U.S. was on this kind of downward slide into a kind of vanishing of United States as we knew it.
What do you mean by civil racism? That's kind of a provocative title.
Absolutely. It comes from a concern that people, oftentimes when there's violence in the streets, they argue for a kind of civility and that we need to have civil relations with one another. And so I was curious about what that meant. And in thinking about it and thinking about what civility and what civil meant, what it turns out is that it usually is about a kind of hierarchy and reaffirming a hierarchy. So on one hand, you have people who argue that that civility is about belonging, it's about trust, it's about mutual respect, reciprocity, and cooperation. But what happens is that we haven't done the kind of necessary work to get us to those kinds of relationships where we can have those conversations from positions of equality. And so with civil racism, it looks at the everyday behaviors, the way that we in our everyday lives, we reestablish racist practices. And it really fits into the kind of conversations that we're having now about implicit bias and about microaggressions, and the way that even though certain people and some individuals, many individuals, espouse interest in racial equality, interest in fairness and justice, that actually they're on an everyday basis performing these kinds of racist practices that reentrench or reestablish racism in a larger situation.
And then when people of color lash out against racism, that is seen as violent. But the violence of day-to-day racism, when it's cloaked in civility, is generally invisible, right?
Absolutely. And see, what happens is that I argue the very first line of my book is protest disrupts the status quo. And the status quo is perceived to be civility, the baseline of civility. And yet what happens is that many people, voters and citizens, don't realize that to have that kind of status quo, to have that civility, there's multiple forms of sanctioned violence, state violence, that that we see as normal and part of our everyday lives. So that's the criminal justice system, that's mass incarceration, that's poverty, that is police surveillance, all of these different forms that are considered to be part of our lives, that that is the violence of civility.
And so, of course, the interesting moment during the 1992 rebellion was this plea by Rodney King, the person who was at the center of what sparked the anger, when he basically said, can't we all just get along? In a way, that was a plea for civility, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we can understand why that might be the case, especially for Rodney King himself, who was this image and this icon of what happened. The acquittal of the four police officers and the trial, it came at a certain moment after years of police surveillance, police harassment, police discrimination and brutality, and also a kind of forgetting of Latinos in Los Angeles, of their own kind of interactions with immigration services, and then also with the police. So in some ways, there's this kind of way that even Rodney King, yes, on one hand, calls for civility and many, many people support it. And yet on the other hand, there's this deep well of frustration that takes its form in terms of violent acts.
Now, the U.S.'s race problem has traditionally, maybe not as much today, but certainly in the 90s, been seen literally in black and white terms, that
Absolutely.
Racial problems were between blacks and whites, which left groups like Asian Americans and, as you mentioned, Latino Americans kind of out of the whole conversations. How did the L.A. rebellion challenge those assumptions, particularly given the tensions that were then exposed between the Korean American community in South L.A., who were primarily grocery store owners, and the black community in South L.A.? You know, in the end, one story that emerged out of all of this was that this was a problem between Koreans and blacks, and that whites didn't have much to do with it.
Yes, absolutely. So the history of racial violence is perceived as black, white in U.S. history. And then here in Los Angeles, you see another instance of black-Korean conflict, which had been in the news, perhaps not in the same way as Los Angeles, but had been in the news since the 1970s in Chicago, and then in New York most recently in 1989 and 1990 with one of the longest boycotts of the Red Apple grocery store that was owned by a Korean American. So you have this history, and yet you have the way that the LA rebellion is understood as a Black Korean conflict. And there's a couple of things. One is that Korean Americans and Korean American studies in the university setting really identifies 1992 as this moment where it's this understanding that they are American, that this is an American problem, this is an American society that they are part of in thinking about race relations. So you have this notion that on one hand, that Asian Americans are sort of forgotten in thinking about the history of U.S. racial interactions and racial relationships. But on the other, you have this idea of Black Korean conflict. Now, what's also fascinating, too, about the area in which South Los Angeles is that it's 50% Latino by this moment, and yet it's perceived as predominantly Black Korean, not at all about Latino-Korean conflict. So the changing demographics of Los Angeles is not something that is registered in the media. And so the media primarily had two ways of reading the LA Rebellion, which is black-white in this historic way, or black-Korean in this new way. And what ends up happening is that Korean-Americans become obviously a kind of honorary white in this paradigm. And it's important to think about how then whiteness drops out, as I mentioned before, in Latinos drop out of this. And so people, when they understand the Black Korean conflict, they really don't think about the other racial groups that are also in the mix as well.
And you point out in your book that Korean Americans were made so invisible during the media coverage of the 1992 rebellion. They were not really given voice, were they?
Not at all, yes. And so you have Angela Oh, a second-generation Korean-American lawyer who emerges from this moment and then ends up very prominent in President Clinton's administration. But at largely, you know, they're covered over. They might be interviewed, but then there's a media voiceover. And so many Korean-American scholars have talked about the way that Korean-Americans have been forgotten in the discussion of the LA riots and the media representation.
Now, let's talk about the fact that today we continue, even though we're supposed to be a little bit more nuanced in our critiques of race and racism, we continue to have these very sort of monochromatic lenses through which we view race and racism. One is the way in which violence, when it is from, say, people of color or in communities of color, is seen or so different or just decontextualized than, say, violence in white communities. I mean, I'm thinking of the Baltimore uprising, which happened about a year ago. And, you know, then you have sort of white-dominated violence that often takes place in sports arenas or around sporting events, and you see completely different media coverage. Even when there is so much better reason for communities of color to rebel than whites to kind of, you know, break store windows around a sporting event. So can you comment on that?
Absolutely. Civil behaviors are tied to civil bodies. So in other words, if you are African American, if you're a person of color, your body is not considered to be civil or capable of civility in the way that it is defined by the state or by the US government. So when you have bodies that are constantly thought of as not human, one, not civil, and not capable of having civil rights or having their civil rights protected, then when they're on the street and when they're vulnerable, when they're visible, right, those kinds of considerations just kind of fly out the window, that there's the dehumanization that occurs. There's the belief in their lack of civility or their lack of the ability to behave properly, that protesting, that being in the streets, that congregating, all of these things that were that have been vaunted in the and praised from the civil rights movement in the way that we understand it, that none of these things in the present day, these actions in the present day, these behaviors in the present day, are considered to be legitimate. And again, it returns to the notion of civil racism, that some people are civil and some people are not.
You talk in your book about this notion of racial shaming. And this is something, you know, that people of color struggle with on a day-to-day basis. I've certainly felt it in my experiences, that when you do try to bring up microaggressions or even very overt racist experiences that you've had, and if you're talking to a white audience, often you end up being blamed for whatever it is that was done to you. You know, why are you so angry? Especially the standard stereotypes that people of color have of being constantly angry. This is particularly true of African-American women who experience this stereotyping. And you compare it to the so-called slut shaming that happens when women are blamed for being victimized. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because I think not too many people kind of say that out loud.
Well, I firmly believe that we live in two Americas, and it's a different kind of conversation than the Kerner Commission report in 1968 that looked at two Americas in terms of black and white. I think we live in two Americas, one that believes that our judicial system is fair and just, perhaps the most fair and just in the world. And then you have the other America that lives the experience where that is not true. In the same way, I think we live in two Americas in relationship to racial bias, and implicit bias, and microaggressions. That we live in an America where people understand how that functions on a daily basis and how it leads to outcomes of inequality that are quantifiable in terms of job security, even having a career, getting into college, those kinds of things that are markers of middle class and upward mobility. That we live in an America, that there are some who live in an America where that's not true, that there aren't microaggressions and there aren't implicit biases that that people of color face on a daily basis. And so that for me was very telling in reading up on the conversation around Michael Brown's parents who went to Geneva and testified in front of the UN.
And Mike Brown, of course,
exactly,
being
yes.
the teen who was shot in Ferguson, Missouri, sparking the rebellion there and also leading to the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. So they went to Geneva?
They went to Geneva, yes. And they testified in front of the UN. And the UN recognized the connection between U.S. treatment, U.S. police brutality, and police brutality around the world, that more research needed to be done, more data needed to be found.
Now, Lynn, how important is it for us to get it right on issues of race and racism today? And what lessons mm-hmm. can the LA rebellion hold for Black Lives Matter? I mean, we're in a very crucial election year, and racialized rhetoric is treading dangerous ground. And this idea of multiculturalism, which some might dismiss as kind of an old-fashioned idea, is not non-radical as it is still deemed so threatening to an increasingly shrinking white majority. So how do we get it right?
That is a tough question. How do we get it right?
And it's not just about language and depictions, right? It's about justice.
Absolutely. I think it starts with a changing conception of what justice might be, that it's not necessarily through the criminal justice system, one. And then also, I think that there is a kind of way in which different kinds of histories need to be told, and they need to be understood in a way that I don't think has been as full-throated as it could be, not just in terms of recognizing, for example, the repercussions of slavery, the repercussions of Jim Crow segregation, but also the way that those logics, those ways of dealing with populations of people and racial minorities was transferred to other racial minorities, like new immigrants, immigrants of color, Asians, Latinos. And I think that kind of more fully understood history of injustice has not been interrogated, hasn't been taught in classrooms. It's something that maybe we teach at the collegiate level, but it's not something that is standardized in our K through 12 classrooms. And the way in which how we as a society have not come to terms with the legacy of a racial dictatorship, as Howard Minot calls it, that lasted for hundreds of years, you know, and the way that that wealth is so crucial to one's security and stability right now. And it's one of those, it's a growing field, I think, in terms of understanding how the long history of racism has resulted in vast inequalities. And we're just kind of understanding the mechanisms and understanding the exact dollar amounts and things like that. But I really think that that's one of the legacies that I hope for the LA Rebellion in 92, that we're coming up on 24, now almost 25 years, And that is what I would call for, is this kind of comparative racial history of the United States.
Now, finally, the subtitle to your book has the words, "The Crisis of a Racial Burnout." Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I really struggled in the 1990s and the 2000s what to call the violence in 1992. How was it that I could acknowledge each political and social justice goal of each community that was invested in how we understand the LA rebellion? And for me, it became the notion of crisis, which means judgment or decision, and that what we bring to our understanding of what happened in 1992 and the violence in Los Angeles really reflects our political investments. So will we call it a revolution? Will we call it a rebellion? Or will we call it the brutality of the mob, as President George H.W. Bush called it at the time? Will we call it Sa'igu, which means 429, and connects it to a diasporic history of oppression of Koreans around the world? Or will we call it Quemazones, the Great Burning, the way that Hector Tobar, a journalist and writer, has called it in The Tattooed Soldier? Or will we call it civil unrest and civil disturbance, because those are the most kind of apolitical of terms? And so crisis really, for me, embodies this moment of judgment and what our political investments will bring to it. With racial burnout, what I felt in the 1990s and 2000s was that there was this kind of feeling that we had a race fatigue, as someone has called it, a race fatigue, that people didn't want to talk about racial inequality and racial discrimination anymore. And I think when you were talking earlier about people's refusal to talk about implicit biases or microaggressions that people feel, that is racial burnout, that they're tired of talking about discrimination. It should have been solved a long time ago. So on one hand, you have this kind of national conversation about racial discrimination that is seems to be over. But then also you have this people's frustration with the fact that we haven't moved on beyond race. And so that's what racial burnout is it really, it tries to identify this this mood and this atmosphere in talking about race.
Right. And then terms like color blindness or post-racial certainly don't help. Well, I want to thank you so much, Lynn, for joining us today, and best of luck with your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest is Lynn Mie Itagaki. She is an assistant professor of English and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and the program coordinator in Asian American Studies at Ohio State University. We've been discussing her new book, Civil Racism, the 1992 Los Angeles Rebellion and the Crisis of Racial Burnout. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.